It's been my great pleasure over the last 3 years to introduce our president, Professor Jackie Eales, to open the conference. Actually, today that is tinged with a little sadness because actually this is Jackie's last presidential lecture. Not her last lecture, I know, to say quickly. Once get a hold of, we don't let go of people. But I'd like to say this opportunity, so absolutely huge thank you to Jackie. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you so much for your support. Jackie took up a gauntlet laid down by Anne Curry, our previous president, to reach as many branches as possible. I haven't totted up the results yet, but I think it's pretty close. So a warning to any future presidents, two very formidable women have set the challenge high. Right. I would also like to thank Jackie because we're very grateful for a digital project that Jackie introduced by reviving our old pamphlet series as commissioning new books as e-readers. These will soon be available to members through the HA website. They are available on Amazon, so those of you who have some sort of Kindle device, you can read them that way, but they will be available to members pretty soon. So, as Jackie is still president for a few hours, I'm very, very much looking forward to hearing more about Puritan attitudes towards plays and pleasure in the age of Shakespeare. No more cakes and ale. Jackie, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that great welcome. And I'd just like to say it's been a great pleasure being president for the last 3 years. And I wish the new president well. Now, in Twelfth Night, Shakespeare pokes gentle fun at the steward Malvolio as a Puritan. Dost thou think, because thou art virtuous, there shall be no more cakes and ale, demands Sir Toby Belch. Malvolio is duped, as we know, by a forged letter, telling him to smile like a lunatic and to lord it over his fellow servants and Sir Toby Belch. In order to win his mistress's love, and here we've got a fine set of Malvolios. You'll probably recognise Stephen Fry there, Richard Wilson and Derek Jacobi. And of course, Stephen Fry is sporting the famous yellow stockings, cross-gartered stockings, that Malvolio is told to wear to make him look even more insane. After a bit of research, I discovered that wearing yellow stockings was in fact something that fashionable young men who were going courting did at the time. So it adds an extra frisson to the audience reaction when the play was first performed. Now, of course, after a brief period of restraint as a gurning madman, Malvolio is released and exits in humiliation. In reality, though, it was the godly who briefly gained the upper hand against the theatre. In September 1642, the Long Parliament called a halt to public stage plays during the time of civil war. And the reason given was that the spectacles of pleasure, too commonly expressing lascivious mirth and levity, did not agree with public calamities. Instead, people were urged to attend to fasting and prayer for repentance, reconciliation, and peace with God. Now, this was the prelude to a clampdown on the stage and on traditional festivities, which, as you can imagine, was not very popular. In October 1647, the London authorities were given the power to arrest actors. And early the next year, Parliament ordered that actors should be subject to the statute of 1597 for punishing rogues, vagabonds, and sturdy beggars. The public theatres in London were to be pulled down, and anyone attending a play was to be fined. What then lay behind this Puritan war on cakes and ale, plays and pleasure in the 17th century? We should start, I think, by considering who or what a Puritan was. And we all know that Puritans wore black, sober clothing, don't we? Now, I want you to play Spot the Puritan. I want to ask you, does clothing make the man, or in this case, the woman? So, is it the lady on the left with the pointy hat and the rather peculiar relationship with the devil, who might be a witch? Is it the lady on the right with the rather winsome look, the rather low neckline, who might be, what, a courtier, a courtesan? How many of you think the lady on the left might be a Puritan? Quick show of hands. What about the lady on the right? Anybody think she's a Puritan? Oh, you do? Good. It's a trick question. They're both Puritans. So, on the left, we've got Anna Trapnell, who is a female prophet in the 1650s and a member of the Fifth Monarchist Group, calling for an end to secular rule and the coming of Christ, second coming of Christ. Very vocal in criticising Oliver Cromwell's government. Lady on the right, you may recognise Lady Brilliana Harley from a recent issue of The Historian. Absolutely staunch Puritan, supported the Long Parliament until her death in 1643. Now, Brilliana would go out of her way to avoid saying the word Christmas. She used the word Christtide instead, to avoid using that Roman Catholic word Mass. And the word Christtide is a dead giveaway. If you see somebody using the word Christtide, you're looking at a Puritan. Now, Brilliana was also pleased. You can see the wonderful court dress she's got on. Her father was Secretary of State. She did dress in state in silk clothes, light-coloured clothes, low necklines. And she was very pleased when her son, Ned, went to university in 1638 because he had handsome clothes. And she also sent him a hat with a gold and silver hat band. So he was dressed in a silk suit, the Spanish leather shoes, and this gaudy hat band. So I think one thing we need to take on board is that clothes don't necessarily make a Puritan. So similarly, if we take the view that anyone who was a killjoy or opposed the theatre was a Puritan, then we might have one definition of a Puritan, but it won't be a very sophisticated one, it won't be a very accurate one. Margot Heinemann, in her classic work on Thomas Middleton, Puritanism and Theatre, reminds us that at the time, in this period, in Catholic Spain, many of the clergy expressed hostility towards the popular theatre. And the definition of a Puritan is also very slippery. As Anne Hughes has written in an article about Stratford on Avon, Puritanism did not involve exclusive positions, but rather the holding of a conventional Protestant position in an especially zealous and committed form. So we're looking at Patrick Collinson's hotter sort of Protestants. And Anne goes on to argue that the sanction of zealous moral reformation could command broad support at times of social tension, but could easily provoke division and disorder as well. So in order to contextualise the tensions in the relationships between the Puritans and the rest, let's return to Twelfth Night. The play was first performed in 1602, so right at the beginning of the 17th century. And cakes and ale were a familiar pairing in the 17th century, although it may seem rather odd to us today. Samuel Pepys records consuming them in alehouses, and on one occasion he stopped at the Mother Redcap in Holloway, and he notes that outside there was a sign of a woman with cakes in one hand and ale in the other. But Shakespeare, I think, may have been thinking about something else as well. He may have been thinking about the drive against church ales that had taken place in the 1590s. And church ales were a bit like church fetes today, except they held them more frequently. Any excuse for a church ale to raise money and have a good time, and they were off. But the difference, I think, between our rather sedate church fetes today is that the church ales in the Tudor and Stuart period involved more inebriation, violence, and immorality. That is, unless you think that Midsummer Murders really reflects life in the Cotswolds today. In 1594, church ales were prohibited by the magistrates in Somerset, and Devon followed suit in 1599. Now, this was part of a wider drive by Protestants, not just Puritans, against a traditional festive culture, which was linked to the rhythm of the seasons, which was strongly associated with the pre-Reformation Roman Catholic customs. Plays, interludes, disguisings, mummings, masks were all part of the festive calendar. And Twelfth Night, of course, the night of celebrating, eating, drinking, which marked the end of Christmas, was part of this pre-Reformation calendar year. Previously, of course, this would have included celebrations for saints' days with processions, plays, and feasts. And Patrick Collinson writes of a procession, pre-Reformation procession with St. George and the Dragon, and the dragon was called Old Snap, And old Snap persisted right into Elizabeth's reign, so people didn't want to give up these old customs. Now, Malvolio's disapproval of the Christmas merrymaking is set up by Shakespeare, I think, to lampoon the official but rather sporadic attempt to drive out these old customs. But Shakespeare was also contributing to the comic development of the killjoy, hypocritical Puritan, who was emerging on the stage and in print in the 17th century. Shakespeare's contemporaries, including Thomas Middleton, also contributed to the stereotype, so much so that Patrick Collinson has argued that the stage invented Puritanism, as it was popularly viewed at the time and today as well. Now, it was Ben Jonson, though, who contributed the most to that image. And I wanted to show you at this point some images from some of Jonson's plays. But strangely, they're very infrequently performed. The last time I went to see some plays by Jonson was a good, I think, 25 years ago, when the National Theatre did a whole slew of them. So they did Volpone, they did The Devil is an Ass, which we don't often see, and there don't seem to have been any recent performances in 16th, 17th century costume, which would have been nice to be able to show you what people think Puritans look like, so I haven't been able to do that. But in The Alchemist, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Tribulation and Ananias, a pastor and deacon of Amsterdam, are readily persuaded by the con man Subtle that counterfeiting gold coins is no crime. And they've already admitted to defrauding orphans of their inheritances, so they easily fall for the lure of the gold. They're one of a series of gulls who come in and think that Subtle and his associates can turn base metal into gold. So this is a very topical subject in the 17th century. In Bartholomew Fair, which I think is even funnier, the small band of Puritans are very swiftly undone by the carnal delights of the fair. So they become drunk, the women are suspected of being prostitutes, and so on. One of the characters in Bartholomew Fair has the wonderful name of Zeal of the Land Busy. Now, that really does give you an insight into what Jonson thought these Puritans were up to. Now, Zeal of the Land had been a baker, but he'd given up his trade out of Puritan scruple, because he realised that his Banbury cakes were served at bridales. Those weren't necessarily weddings. They were like church ales that were held as a benefit for one of the parishioners. Maypoles, Morrises, and such profane feasts and meetings. Now, this is a contemporary painting of, we don't know the exact title. It might be a wedding feast, it might be a fete, held in Bermondsey. In the paintings about 1560. So I think you can just see. Right, that seems to have. Yes, you can just see, I think that's meant to be the Tower of London up there. But you can see here, there's a procession with these cakes coming in here. I'll show you a detail from the painting in a minute so you can see it. And this might be the couple here getting married, perhaps. Perhaps not, some dancing going on. Interestingly, some musicians here. And then these people in black, it's not quite clear why they're dressed in black, but that's the detail. Sorry, it's the 1580s, not 1560s. So you can see the cakes in much greater detail there. Huge cakes being brought in to be consumed. And of course, we know about the different cakes. There are Banbury cakes, there are Shrewsbury cakes, and so on. And they are sweet cakes or biscuits that people ate. So Jonson's plays clearly satirise the exiled English congregation in Amsterdam and also the famed Puritans of Banbury just down the road from Stratford. But I think that his aim was also much closer to home. The Alchemist was written in 1610 for performance in London's Blackfriars Theatre, where it was set. It was set in the parish of Blackfriars. And since Elizabethan times, the church there had been the centre of godly Puritan preaching. And one of Jonson's characters in the plays thus describes the sober, scurvy, precise neighbours who had hardly smiled twice since the king had come in 1603. Now, it wasn't just a godly congregation, cheek by jowl with the theatre, the playgoers, that made this such a good joke for the audience at the time. In 1596, 31 inhabitants of the Blackfriars had petitioned the Privy Council to prevent the opening of a new playhouse. and they managed to delay the opening for 4 years. In 1600, the site was leased to the children of the chapel, who performed Middleton and Jonson's plays there. And from 1608, it was actually used by Shakespeare's own company, the company he part-owned, the King's Men. And that's the petition, which is in the National Archives, so you can see the names there. And the petitioners were headed by Elizabeth Russell, Dowager Lady Russell, and strangely enough, the second signature there is, or the third one down, oh, that says Dowager, the second one is Lord Hunsdon, who was actually the patron of the players who wanted to move in. And included in this lineup is Stephen Egerton, the parish minister. And the petition complained that now that the Lord Mayor had banished the players from the city, they had moved into the Liberties. And it went on to state that the public playhouse would be a great annoyance because of the gathering of vagrant and lewd persons, because of the danger of the play, and because of the actors' drums and trumpets, which would disturb people at times of divine service. Now, as this petition shows, it's not easy to separate out the motives of individuals. Stephen Egerton, the minister, may well have just been worried about the effects of the plays on his parishioners, perhaps disturbing divine service, but also leading them astray. Lord Hunsdon, the actor's own patron, may have been overcome by a fit of nimbyism. In fact, the rooms that they'd hired were right next door to his plot, and that's what this petition says, that the playrooms are hard by or adjacent to Lord Hunsdon's premises. Now, Lady Russell was a very enthusiastic consumer of Egerton's sermons, and I think she may have had mixed motives for signing the petition. She obviously heads it, she's the great patron in the parish, and she's probably worried about nimbyism, she's probably worried about the congregation as well. And as Anne Hughes argued in that article I mentioned earlier, the interests of Puritans and others could easily unite under social pressure. There were then a spectrum of reasons for opposing the Elizabethan and Jacobean theatre, which could also include arguments of moral reform as well, if need be. The city authorities had formally banned unlicensed stage performances in 1574 by an Act of Common Council. And this act lists a dizzying number of reasons. It's the kitchen sink, everything is in there. Almost anything you can think of is probably in there. There were so many of these reasons, I couldn't include them here because we would have gone way over the allotted time we've got. But included in the list is disorders and violence, illicit sex, drawing people away from Sunday services, robberies, health and safety issues also loom very large because sundry slaughters and mayhemings of the Queen's subjects have happened by ruins of scaffolds, frames and stages, and by engines, weapons and powder used in plays. Clearly the theatre was a dangerous place to be in Shakespeare's England. And famously, of course, the Globe Theatre itself did burn down in 1613. So not a very good neighbour to have, I would say, in a town that was full of wooden structures that would catch light very easily with thatched roofs. Now, this act coincided with two further developments. One was the move of plays away from courtyards of London inns, premises in London, to the purpose-built theatres of the suburbs on Bankside and in North London. Now, this map gives you an idea of the extent of the centre of London here, this black line. And these are some of the places where the playhouses go out to. There's the curtain there, the theatre there. Down here we've got the Blackfriars over here. And of course we've got the Bankside theatres over here. And you can see this is very built up. Over on Bankside, of course, it's a lot of open fields. And people used to walk out there for leisure on a Sunday, perhaps, to get some exercise. So having the theatres there, of course, was a lure. If the theatres are there, people are going to go to them. This is a very famous image of the Swan Theatre from 1596, very reminiscent of the modern Globe Theatre that we've now got. This shows us, this is a map from 1560, showing you again how built up the north side of the river is, as opposed to the south side, bank side. And we've got the bull and the bear baiting rings just here. So these are other added attractions that people could go to. And this is that's just a detail of that to show you the bull baiting and the bear baiting. And then we've got Hollar's very famous map of London from 1647, very detailed. But in fact, apparently he's got the globe and the bear baiting back to front. That should be the bear baiting over there. That should be the globe over there. But you can see that these delights are all available outside the Liberties. Now, linked to this movement to Bankside was the growing literature of religious complaint against the public stage in the 1570s and 80s. Preachers and writers who invade against the theatre in these decades were a motley crew of Puritans. Yes, there were Puritans, but also hired hacks as well. And they included the fiery Puritan preacher, John Field, and the playwriters, Stephen Gosson and Anthony Munday, quite amazingly. This is Field's tirade against the theatre from 1583, a godly exhortation by occasion of the late judgment of God showed at Paris Garden, where were assembled by estimation above 1,000 persons, whereof some were slain, and of that number at the least, as is credible, reported the third person maimed and hurt. And that was because the scaffold had collapsed that people were sitting on. And it's not clear how many people were actually killed, but Field is doing the fiery Puritan preacher bit and getting up and saying, fire and brimstone, you shouldn't be at these kinds of entertainments. This is the hand of God killing people for this kind of activity. Now, as Peter Lake has pointed out in this 765-page book, The Antichrist's Lewd Hat, Gosson and Munday, who were involved in this literature of complaint, were no Puritans. As I said, they wrote plays themselves. But they were anxious to gain patronage from any quarter and may have both been paid to write against the theatre by the city fathers. This is work by Philip Stubbs, very famous work, The Anatomy of Abuses, which goes through all sorts of moral abuses and deals with the theatre in passing. And Lake tells us in that book that Field, Gosson, Munday, and moderate Puritans like Stubbs all helped to create a Puritan discourse against plays. And this discourse included complaints about the corruption of both men and women. They would be trained in the devil's arts of seduction, wantonness, drunkenness, and cozening, both by the exploits on the stage and by the company of the punks and cut purses in the audience as well. I'll just go back to Lake's book, actually, because that's a very interesting image. It shows you St. Paul's Cross, which is an outdoor pulpit. See the preacher just here. So this is the kind of pulpit that men like Field might have occupied at various times. And you can see the city fathers up here. So Lake is arguing that there's a collusion between the preachers here and the city fathers. The preachers criticise the city fathers for not reforming the theatre. The city fathers run off to the Privy Council saying, oh, look, we're being criticised from the pulpit. You must help us to do something. And you can see this very sober, godly congregation here of city merchants and so on listening to this preacher. The trouble was, though, that royal and aristocratic backing for the professional theatre meant that there was very little that could be done to suppress the playhouses and to suppress the acting companies. Instead, the actors were increasingly subjected to centralised control. Acting companies were granted royal patents and were licensed to perform in the provinces as well as in the summer season. Central control extended to the punishment of companies that performed plays that criticised the government. We can think of various examples of this, but in 1597, two actors in the Isle of Dogs were arrested for performing a lewd and seditious play, and so too was one of the authors, Ben Jonson. So there's clearly a tension here between the royal patronage of the stage and political and religious satire as well. And so we find that the Crown is involved in trying to control the players. In 1603, immediately on his accession, James I issued a proclamation which noted that the Sabbath had previously been greatly neglected in England and he commanded that no bear or bull baiting, no interludes or common plays, or other unlawful pastimes should be held on a Sunday. And this was followed 3 years later by an Act of Parliament in restraint of abuses by players, which set down fines for profane or jesting use of the words God, Jesus Christ, the Holy Ghost, or the Trinity on stage. So there's clearly a concern about blasphemy. I wonder whether behind this there might also be a fear that the pre-Reformation miracle plays were still having an afterlife, that people were still perhaps performing some of them in the provinces. But it wasn't just the central and the metropolitan authorities that were concerned about controlling the actors. In 1602, Stratford Town Council, here in Stratford, made an order banning plays with a penalty of 20 shillings. In 1612, the fine was increased to £10, which was an enormous amount of money at the time. We're talking about thousands of pounds. And the argument given was that other well-governed cities and boroughs didn't allow plays. And these measures have been linked by Anne Hughes and others to the Puritans on the town council in Stratford. In Canterbury, similarly, in 1636, James Nicholson, the mayor, complained to Archbishop Laud about the stage players from London's Fortune Theatre, who had recently acted for a week during Lent under licence from the king. He complained that the plays were a nursery for drunkenness and disorder, especially as they'd been performed during a religious season in Lent. And the mayor was quick to point out that he wasn't concerned about himself, but about his office and the affront to government. And as we have seen, the control of the theatres was just one facet of a wider concern about traditional festive culture, which included Christmas and May Day celebrations and Sunday observance. So here we've got the Maypole, and Philip Stubbs said it was a stinking idol. You can see people dancing around it, decorated with green boughs and so on, people obviously having a good time. Now in 1619, the Maypole here in Stratford was left up from May until mid-September. So you can see that the potential there for people to keep on celebrating around it was there. In September, the town's bailiff and an alderman removed it because they wanted to hold the September fair and they thought it was an obstruction. But a group of men promptly restored it, and there was a standoff between the two groups. And this standoff is evidence of a deeper division in the town, which had recently appointed a Puritan preacher. So there are groups on the town council pro and against this Puritan preacher. Now, needless to say, Maypoles were banned by the Long Parliament in 1644 because it was argued they encouraged the profanation of the Sabbath. And it was indeed Sunday observance that was at the heart of a good deal of the debate about festive culture. We've got this book here, Dies Dominica, the Day of the Lord, which contrasts the works of light and the works of darkness. So during darkness hours, people are sleepy, slothful, not vigilant. During daylight, people should be aware, spiritually aware and praying. They should be at church on a Sunday. They should be thinking about private religious devotion on a Sunday. They should visit the sick and the dying. They should give out food and alms in charitable works to the poor. However, if you're not vigilant, you'll be dancing, you'll be playing cards, you'll be carousing and getting drunk. You might even be working on a Sunday, which you shouldn't be doing. So that's the wonderful contrast there in that one image of what Puritans and very godly people thought you should be doing on a Sunday, and what other people thought you might be up to on a Sunday. Now, this image is reinforced by the issue in 1618 by James I of the Book of Sports. And in that, he defined the activities that were allowed on Sundays. Bear and bull baiting, interludes or plays, and bowling were not allowed. Bowling wasn't even allowed for the common people. It was only the elite who could play bowls. After church services on a Sunday, however, the following were allowed: dancing, archery, May games, whitsunales, Morris dances, maypoles, so long as there was no impediment or neglect of divine service. So long as you go to church in the morning, you can get out there and enjoy yourself in the afternoon. This book was reissued in 1633 by Charles I after a dispute in Somerset, again about church ales, about whether it was legal to ban them or not. Now, needless to say, the Book of Sports provoked an intense reaction from Puritans who believed that Sunday should be given over entirely to religion. In 1643, the Long Parliament ordered that the book should be burnt, and the next year an ordinance banned all work, games, church ales, and even bell ringing on a Sunday. So if you're a bell ringer, watch out. But the Puritans had even bigger prey in their sights. In 1647, an ordinance banned celebrations for Easter, Whitsun, and Christmas. So Christmas was completely banned. And the reason for this was that all of these festivals had been superstitiously observed. Now, just like the church ales, Whitsun and May Day celebrations had been periodically revoked by town councils and magistrates since Elizabethan times. But the ban on Christmas was new. And you can imagine what happened, can't you? What would happen today if we tried to ban Christmas celebrations? It provoked a series of riots in London, in Ipswich, in Oxford, and most famously in Canterbury, where it was the prelude to the outbreak of the Second Civil War. This is a pamphlet from 1653, and it's the Vindication of Christmas. And you can see these characters here are having a debate with Christmas in the middle. There's Christmas. This chap saying, keep out. This chap is saying, come back. You're welcome. Do not fear. So there's a real cultural and spiritual divide about how you celebrate Christmas. So in order to bring all this together, to conclude, as we know, the Puritan Revolution of the 1640s and 50s was going to be a failure. The aspiration for England to become a godly commonwealth was undermined by traditionalists who adhered to the worship of the Anglican Church and the familiar pre-Reformation calendar year. Now, I've argued here that Puritans are rather difficult to pin down. They didn't all dress in black, modest clothing, as we've seen. They also shared some of their concerns about the theatre and the festive year with non-Puritans. The king, the Privy Council, civic authorities, judges and magistrates all wanted some measure of control and restraint, especially on the Sabbath or on part of the Sabbath. And as Anne Hughes' definition of Puritanism, which I cited earlier, suggests, it was all a matter of degree. But when the gloves were off in the 1640s, we can see exactly what a Puritan England looked like. It was a land without plays, without maypoles, without Christmas, with severe restraints on pleasure pursuits on a Sunday. And Shakespeare may have helped to shape the popular view of the stock Puritan figure in Twelfth Night. But when we look at the landscape of the late 1640s, we might pause to consider whether he had a point. In fact, I was thinking about this while I was looking at the material, and I was started off very enthusiastically because I'm quite fond of Puritans, strangely enough. And that's because they're very anti-establishment before the Civil War. So they're constantly sort of thorns in the side of the establishment. And I think, oh, yes, 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 they're stirring things up. That's fascinating. The minute they become the establishment, though, things are rather different. They're rather rigid. They don't want freedoms for other people that they're claiming for themselves in terms of religious worship, for example. So they become perhaps less attractive and less interesting. I think that image of the killjoy hypocritical Puritan perhaps isn't right, because I don't think they're hypocritical. I think they're deadly serious. They really do want to ban some of these pleasure pursuits. So if we go back to the landscape of the 1640s and 50s, I think it helps to explain in part why the Puritan Revolution was a failure and why the Merry Monarch was welcomed back in 1660 with such enthusiastic celebration. And as he processed from Dover to London in 1660, I've no doubt that Charles II's return was greeted with the consumption of an awful lot of cakes and ale. Thank you.